Hello and welcome to the Fitness Mindset Podcast with Kate Newdecker. So in this episode, I'm joined by Paul Dermody. He's been on the podcast before and he's a fellow coach who I often chat to about things that are going on in the fitness industry, any nutrition related topics. And I thought it'd be really good for us to record what we were chatting about and upload it as a podcast. It is quite informal, but I think it will be helpful for some to listen to. So I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so today I have on the podcast with me Paul Dermody, who is a fellow coach who has a lot of experience as a fitness coach. He's recently come back from an injury, which I'm sure we're going to talk about a little bit more. But really, today's podcast is actually just going to be really informal and having a chat, because I know me and Paul usually cover a lot of things that might actually be helpful for anyone who is going to eavesdrop or listen. So thanks for popping on and having a chat, Paul.
My pleasure. How are we?
All good. So you're in Ireland right now, yeah?
I am. I am back in Ireland since Christmas. I was over in your area of the world in Barcelona for the 7 months before Christmas, and moved back here. I have to say the weather is probably not as good as I would like it to be, but yeah, I'm settling back.
Absolutely. And that's actually how me and Paul got to know each other. It's through the podcast, because I think you must have seen something on social media about me being in Barcelona or someone you know. Yeah. And then someone put us in touch with each other. And then from that, we ended up actually having a lot in common in terms of us having our online coaching and moving to Barcelona at the time. So since then, we've found that we have so much common ground. It's really a nice thing about social media that you can find people like that.
Yeah, it is. It's one of I'm actually such a huge fan of social media. I don't personally experience many of the negative side effects that people do, but I think it's one of the wonderful things about it. I was in Barcelona. I was new. I didn't have the language. For a friend of mine, I don't know how they stumbled upon your account, but they let me know that you're another trainer living in Barcelona, and I just thought, you know what, it's nice to link up with somebody who's on similar mission, similar mindset, similar thought process, and probably in a similar position with the language in a new city as well.
Absolutely. Are you still practicing your Spanish?
I haven't done it for the last 2 weeks, just because I was away on holiday, and for the first time in 4 years, with the exception of actual just client work, I just switched off completely as best I could from the phone and from doing, I nearly think, maybe you'll agree, maybe you'll disagree, but we nearly get caught up almost too much on these, my perfect list to success, I better do my checklist every day, and I actually, for Orla's, my girlfriend's sake, and the fact I was there with her and my best friend, I just decided to switch off as much as possible. So to answer your question, no, I haven't done it in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I feel myself getting a little bit rustier. How's yours coming along, actually?
I feel like I'm just prioritizing it more. Before, I was very much oh, do you know what? I'm rubbish at Spanish. This is really crap. Never mind. And I just kind of brushed it off. But now I'm really kind of owning it and trying to do 20 minutes a day, and I'm taking lessons and doing all the...
Are you taking lessons? Stuff.
Yeah, I started taking lessons. So it's learning the verbs from scratch. And I got my housemate last night and she tested me on all the verbs and stuff. And it's really different. Instead of learning about fitness, nutrition and biochemistry, I'm doing that in the evening. And it's quite nice, actually. It's quite nice to be learning something different.
Yeah, well, you talked about just the fact I injured myself, for anyone who's listening and probably doesn't have a clue. I dislocated my shoulder for the billionth time, but this was particularly nasty. But one of the things that's helped me a lot mentally get past the injury, because being in shape is something I do take a tremendous amount of enjoyment in, is having other tasks and meanings and goals and things that are not gym related. It's nice to feel like you're in decent shape, and I love it. Mm-hmm. But when I can't do it and I can't do my weight training, then the next best thing is, do your 10,000 steps a day and pop on a Spanish podcast whilst improving your intelligence on a specific topic. And I find it's actually a really nice outlet to have, where nice little bit of focus, not just vanity, not just goal related. It takes that focus, that almost obsessive focus, off a certain body composition and just puts it into other areas of life. And then while you're out walking and strolling anyway, you're keeping yourself that little bit more active. So I think it's the positive catch 22.
Absolutely. And it's kind of that thing that I know that we've spoken about this before is like, oh, actually, like when something bad happens, just seeing the good in it and being like, oh, that's actually a good thing that happened because I could then turn my focus over to this and I actually was better in this area. Like there's always a positive in any shit scenario that happens. And that does sound like I'm being a bit like Pollyanna, but it's the only way you can look at it. But also it's so true with rubbish things that happens. And I've never met anyone so positive after dislocating their shoulder. Like it was ridiculous. Speaking to Paul, I was like, oh, are you okay? Like, oh my God, that must have really hurt. And you're like, well, what can I do? Like, that's how it is. And it's really, I know you've got a lot of people saying that they found it inspiring, but you were just like, how else would I be? There's no other way that I'd handle this.
I certainly don't see it as inspiring. I talk about it the odd time on my social, certainly, but there's a book that strikes me a lot called Man's Search for Meaning. And one of my biggest personal pet peeves is my own tendency to read maybe a business book and procrastinate on it. And I'm really trying to wean out that aspect of my personality. And I'm doing well at it, if I'm entirely honest. I won't do false modesty. I'm doing better on it than I would have been. But one thing I'm not going to do, if I consume anything like Man's Search for Meaning, which is very heavily philosophical, or at least that's what I interpret it to be, I'm not going to ignore the core message in that book. And when you listen to Man's Search for Meaning and you hear him say they're one meal from death, they're so starved, like a broken arm to me just seems like not much of a problem. And if anything, I'm telling clients every day of the week, lean into the difficulty, you know, like it sucks, this difficulty that you can't see right now, whatever obstacle it is, if it's trying to teach you to become the person you need to become. It's trying to teach you mental resilience. It's trying to teach you toughness. Like my I've gathered, because usually I'm largely quite a confident dude now, I wasn't always, is my mental resilience is coming as a result of having to tolerate such an amount of physical pain. I've been hit by a car. I have arthritis. I've dislocated both shoulders. And all the physical pain that I have to overcome, and that sounds so dramatic, is trying to actually teach me to A, be a better trainer and train around the injuries, and B, actually develop the mindset of the characteristics I need to become. And it's no different to what I tell clients who are struggling with their own stuff that maybe in the past I might have rolled my eyes and thought, that's not a problem. Like, you know, and now I'm like, you know what? Everything's a problem depending on how you interpret it. It's just, have you looked at it from a different perspective? So that's why I'm good, if I dare say so, at dealing with the perspective of injury or any kind of annoyance. But I mean, I don't have the holier than thou, just because I think this way, you should think that way. It's not how everybody deals with certain things.
It's just, yeah, exactly. It's what, it wouldn't be helpful if you were like, oh, well, I've had this and this and this, and so you should be able to put up with this. It's how you perceive it and your past experience. Like, everyone perceives pain differently. And I think that's, it's such an individual thing that there's so a lack of knowledge about in terms of like pain management, that there needs to be so much more, there needs to be so much more looked into and discussed. For us to then be like, oh, well, you should just, you know, train through it. You should just carry on with it. And actually, when it comes to injuries and pain and that kind of thing, that's, it's so individual. It's not a blank statement. But like you say, it's just not helpful if you're just going to be like, just, get on with it.
But, I agree.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in terms of like, we're getting onto a lot of chat about injury, and obviously this is not our specialization, but it's more kind of like personal experience and anecdotal stuff. But what are some of the things that helps you get into that place of not, because some people might be like, okay, Paul really dealt with that injury really well. How can I take steps to deal with that injury a little bit better? My injury a little bit better, for example.
Well, if you're a competitive athlete, I'm probably going to get really quiet, because I imagine if you're a competitive athlete, it's very difficult to cope with the fact that you've had your discipline taken away from you. But in saying that, my body weight training, my exercise is something that I take tremendous passion and love in as well. So, I mean, but overall, I've done the whole men's physique competing thing. I've done photo shoots. I've done the single digit body fat and all that stuff. And like, I say this a lot. I talk about it a lot to people, to clients, and it sounds like I'm just saying this for the sake of saying it in 2019, but I'm really not. They don't bring you any additional happiness being a certain body fat unless you fix the right mentality. since I've been in and out of gyms, injured and whatnot, but I've been in and out of gyms since my late teens. Like, that's how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of calories tracked and eaten, how many protein shakes bought, how many workouts done, how many diet plans wasted money on. And it's never, ever, ever, ever given me what I needed until I got into the mentality to realize that unless I perceive myself to be, like, enough or, you know, attractive enough without a certain body composition to some degree, while still trying to work hard towards a goal, I was never going to be enough anyway. So I think a lot of the mistake people make is they get attached to some ideal of a perfect body composition, which doesn't exist because the bar moves. Mm-hmm. So I have the hindsight of knowing that when I was competing in Men's Physique, 5% body fat, 6% body fat, whatever it was, it didn't bring me any additional happiness. Mm-hmm. So at least now when I gain a pound or two or five of body fat, it's not the end of the world. It really isn't the end of the world because, like, it being leaner, I don't want, first and foremost, my self-esteem is not getting wrapped to a body fat percentage anymore, which is fine. The biggest nuisance for me is I love feeling that little bit fitter and sharper. I love feeling that bit sharper. So that's probably just the hardest part to get around. And then that does affect my mood and energy for the rest of the day, as much as I try not to project it onto other people.
Yeah.
I honestly think it comes down to the fact that if you truly realize and truly internalize and don't attach your self-esteem to a body composition and realize that a lot of what you're comparing yourself to is, like, heavily edited, heavily mm-hmm. photoshopped, or heavily drugged up and dehydrated, you start to realize, you know what, there actually is no end to this body composition thing. A lot of it's fake. I might as well just run my own race, deal with my own limitations, count my own blessings, and just roll with it that way, which sounds a little bit easier said than done, but I actually think it's quite practical. Otherwise, you're just going to constantly be in a state of, I want, I want, I want, I wish, I wish, I wish, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I think it's because bodybuilding and physique competing, I'm not saying this for everyone because it would be an incorrect statement. However, it sometimes can be a band-aid for other things. Like, for example, someone said something when someone's younger, they've taken that insult and then they felt crap about it. To feel crap about it, they've tried to make themselves feel better by changing the way they look. And that's kind of been like a cycle that's gone on and on and on. And that can be bodybuilding, going to the gym. And it's actually kind of unraveling that. And I think you've said it before that you kind of unraveled that and kind of like look back to where it come from. I personally had to unravel it and look back to where it came from in terms of like doing photo shoots and that kind of thing. And it's really difficult to do so. Like you say, it's not, you can just be like, oh, like snap out of it. You know, it's easier said than done. But what do you think was the turning point for you?
When I got off the bodybuilding stage, we're talking almost about injury, but in terms of my mental turning point, I'm visceral to bad energy, and I hate two-faced. I'd like to think, you know, I hate two-faced people. I hate backhandedness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like insincerity, and I just the things you see when you're in the competitive side of the industry. Well, first and foremost, everybody's lying about their drug use and their fat burning use. First and foremost, and people are comparing them. People are comparing their walking on foot to somebody else's Concord journey. Second, I used to see everybody. This was probably the most bizarre thing, and it's a habit like I couldn't get into. I saw like mostly bikini girls, but sometimes guys as well. Like, take a screenshot of a tub of ice cream or a multi-pack of chocolate, put it on their Instagram story and be like, all the carbs, all the food, and then put the food back away and not touch it. And then I would actually have my own clients come to me and say, oh, you know, Jenny Bikini or Tommy Muscles eats 17 packs of whatnot, but he has a six pack and I don't. And I was thinking, no, they don't. They're full of shit. They're talking bollocks. And then just as a whole, I just noticed how everybody was just completely wrapped up, almost so self-absorbed in that mindset. And I thought, fair enough, if that's what you want to do, that's totally cool. But that's not me. It's not who I am inherently as a character. And then I was able to almost 180 and come out of that circle almost as soon as I entered it.
Yeah, it's so, I think when you see stuff like that, it does put you off it. Like, it's funny when you said that about like people like taking photos and stuff and not actually eating it. And I was going to post this the other day. I think I got rid of it because I didn't want to piss too many people off. But I was going to say something like, somewhere there is a Fitspo, literally saying that they actually just eat pizza when really they're going to go back to eating cucumber dipped in stevia in a few minutes. Like, there is, people don't eat like that the whole time. However, they like to present that dream. And because we see it from the back and we see the full picture, we kind of detest that side of it. However, I can imagine just absorbing that information, it must be very confusing and also very kind of, it is harmful. It is harmful in a way.
It is, and you know what? It's funny because I don't actually think the people doing it mean harm. I think there is an element of narcissism, but I actually know some somewhat reasonably nice characters who would have been in the mindset of put 10 tubs of Ben and Jerry's on their story, but really they're grating up bloody zucchini or courgette and eating it and pretending it's porridge instead. And then, like I say, friends and clients of mine will say, oh, how are they getting away with that? And I'm like, look, the responsibility and the onus is on you to start looking after who you follow and what you eat. Don't worry about what anybody else is up to.
Absolutely. I think you can blame social media. You can blame other people quite a lot for this stuff. But it's up to you what you absorb. And you've just got to literally look at everything with a pinch of salt and be like, oh, it might not be real. Like, even like me and you, what we post, even like everything, like just just question everything because you don't know what you're absorbing. It's your brain. Like, just, you know, be smart about it.
I 100% agree with you. I mean, you see what I choose to share. Like, you see, I have a business page. I put up mostly business content, and then every now and again, I'll smack up a selfie of me and Orla in New York. And people are like, oh my God, that looks amazing. That looks amazing. I'm like, yeah, but you don't see the fact that, you see, you don't see the fact that one of my philosophies in a relationship is, I always joke about this, but I don't want Orla to hate me in 10 years, which sounds a bit grim, but what do a lot of couples do? They don't like talk, they don't communicate, you know, I leave my smelly socks on the floor, that drives her crazy, instead of her telling me today, she waits 10 years and it unfolds, and then I realize that she's hated me and hoped I would change for the last 10 years. Yeah. Now, I'm being a bit tongue-in-cheek because largely we don't have any issues like that at all because we communicate well. But I show you the highlights. Like, I show you me and Orla in New York, me and Orla when we traveled last year, me and Orla being in Vietnam this year. And it's just like, oh, Paul and Orla are always on the go. And it's like, yeah, you know, because that's two little moments I enjoyed that I chose to share. I mean, you don't see any of the other 23 hours, 59 minutes of my day. So
exactly. And you're not going to be one to post you working and be like, oh, grind, hustle, no, how much I'm working. No. It's like, no one gives a shit. But other people might do that. So it's really hard that people can judge from a snapshot. Like, it's the same with me in Barcelona. I worry about putting stuff because I'm like, oh, I don't want to piss people off by putting, like, me on the beach. Because I'm not always on the beach. I'm rarely on the beach. But then I happen to want to post it when I'm on the beach. I'm like, but I like the photo. Like, it's weird. Like, and you know, but you just got to not really care what people think. But at the same time, like,
I completely get it. But like, I talked about it on my daily email yesterday. But like, you're that person to someone else. Like, when it's easy to sit and condemn somebody else, for having a six pack and showing it online, but then Valentine's Day comes and then you're putting up your couple selfies. So is it better to be single and ripped, or in a relationship and fat? Or when you have your degree, or when you buy your first house, or when you travel, these are all things that people put up. And then, like, certain aspects of life, like, nobody's got all of those aspects of life down. And everybody's comparing themselves versus certain aspects of others' life, and it's going to happen. It's just, it's always going to happen. So I just, the control, it's up to us to control how we think, how we eat, how we live, how we conduct ourselves, because otherwise, you know, it's just going to be this endless buzz dribble of comparison. And go back to your original question, I kind of sussed that out very, very quickly, that I was like, oh, people are only going to share what they want online, and a lot of it's not even going to be true in the first place. I'm comparing myself off things that aren't even true. So it was easy for me to just go, do you know what, fuck this, I'm just going to go and focus on what's important.
Yeah, 100%. And it's kind of that thing with social media. It's like, do you feel like you have a responsibility in terms of, like, posting food and what you eat? Do you ever get comments about it?
No, I don't feel like a responsibility to anything, but I actually like the idea of putting up some of my food sometimes, because I try and keep a six-pack year-round. I don't always do it, but I try to. And, like, then it looks like you might look at sometimes the way I train and think he's just a chicken and broccoli guy. And I'm like, no, you don't see the smoothie bowls with granola and stuff. And But then you don't want to be dogmatic about a flexible dieting approach. Food's a funny one. If I've learned one thing from working with clients, I'm sure you'd agree. How everybody interprets food and fear of food and the interpretation of food is a very funny one. So
it's so... every day I come into a new situation where I'm like, wow, that is, I wouldn't have expected you to think that about food or feel that way about food. It's really mind-blowing that it's such a large range that it's eye-opening all the time.
Yeah. And you largely do become your habits. Like, what is it they say? The chains of habits are too light to be felt until they become too heavy to be broken. And, like, that's one aspect. Like, 5 takeaways a week becomes habit in no time. But mm-hmm. similarly, on the other flip side, I've seen people who are under such misconceptions. They're like, you know, no one should eat bread, nobody should eat potatoes, nobody yeah. should eat fruits. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, when I put up my own food, I don't put a lot of it up anymore, just because mm-hmm. I have not seen the value in doing that personally. I don't think people, but maybe there is, maybe there totally is. I just haven't seen it.
Yeah, exactly. I just feel like every time I post something, I've got to put a disclaimer with it. Like, I ate this pizza, but then I ate also some salad the next day, and I kind of took my calories down, and I did this. It's just like, it just gets boring. It's like, well, shouldn't have to give a disclaimer, you know?
Yeah.
Not people aren't children; they can work it out for themselves. So, there is that as well. I think people are getting a little maybe kind of like snowflakes with it as well. You decide what you decide to watch and do and do with your body as well. Now, in terms of kind of, we're kind of getting further into the year, and I think people, I don't know, I've seen it with my clients, they've got the momentum now since the beginning of the new year, so like new clients have got the momentum. What kind of struggles are you seeing amongst clients at the moment in terms of like consistency and adherence, for example?
So I recently, again, I got some terrific advice from, I mean, I feel like I should know this, and I feel like a fraud, and it was just something that I should have known, and it was just a lovely reminder. But I know a friend, and he's a new personal trainer. Mm-hmm. He'd be in his first year, and he said to me the other day, rather recently, mm-hmm. wean out the time wasters. If you don't respect your time, mm-hmm. how do you expect anybody else to? And it mm-hmm. struck me, because I've been trying to help a couple of people. Like, I'll help anybody as best I can for free, but I've been trying to help a couple of people, and they were not taking it at all with any appreciation, very much taking it for granted. And I've gotten very firm lately, both for paying customers and for anybody who tries to get a bit of free assistance. Please don't waste my time. I'm not interested in your money. I don't give a shit. Don't waste my time. Don't waste your money. Don't waste your energy.
Yeah.
So since that's happened, I've been able to attract literally my kind of client, my demographic into my ecosystem. The struggles I still see are somewhat universal. We're humans, we don't tend to play with pragmatism, we tend to play on the extremes of emotion. I find it tends to be very much people who are flying it and in much better shape than they give themselves credit for, but they're in search of perfectionism or some kind of arbitrary happiness that they think they'll just wake up one day and the same shitty habits that have gotten, or not shitty habits, but the same self-deprecating views of themselves will make them happy with themselves one day, if you get me out. Like, and then on the other side, it's people who are, you know, maybe heavy and they inquire and they think, you know, here's my money, make me skinny, or you know, I could never eat chocolate. And like, you definitely could, you just don't eat 10 bars, stop eating yeah. 10 bars, eat 2 bars, eat 1 bar.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the problem I noticed. But I guess if you ask me universally, the one single one, the analogy I give is, if you're hiking and you look at you, I always think I like hiking until I actually go to hike, and then I realize, what the hell am I doing? I don't love hiking as much as I thought I did.
Yeah.
If you look up at the top of the mountain and think, fuck it, I just want to be up there. I just want to be up there. I just want to snap up there. There's no fun. The climb is the journey, is the hike. Getting to the top is just kind of like almost a symbolic representation of the hard work you put in. Mm-hmm. You can't wish yourself up and hate yourself up to the top of the hike and then just love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just say, oh yeah, the hike was incredible, the top was beautiful, but I've hated every single step. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get people into the mindset of, if you can't embrace the difficulty, if you can't enjoy the journey and the difficulty along the way, I think the chances of you being successful are not as high. I actually have one client on Instagram who's documenting his weight loss journey called Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And he's my template of what somebody who uses the insecurity he possesses as a embodiment of everything he doesn't want to be or remain and everything he wants to become.
Yeah.
And he's 94 pounds down now exactly, and he's got a few more to go. And if I could bottle up and formulate what goes through his mind in terms of physical transformation and someone wants to lose 150 pounds, I'd become a millionaire. He'd become a millionaire because he just gets it. You can't hate yourself for the journey. I think that's it. I think it's university people underestimating the amount of the fact that the journey and the process is the goal. There's no outcome without it. If you can't, like, if staying adherent on Tuesday doesn't suit you, then what makes you think Tuesday fortnight at your sister's wedding you're going to be slim?
I think it's probably something actually, it's something that I've seen obviously a lot more with women. I know I work with women a lot more, but so it's probably a bit of a broad statement, but I would say that women, in terms of the gym, they are kind of bred through consumerism, that if you're going to the gym, it's because you hate yourself. If you are going to a spin class, it's because you have calories to work off. And there has been a lot of that, obviously, in magazines and that kind of thing. And there is a slight change in the industry now of, you are not going just to burn calories and because you hate yourself. Like, the amount of stories I saw on social media of girls going, oh, the Victoria's Secret model, like, catwalk, I'm going to go to the gym tomorrow, I hate myself. I'm like, well, it doesn't matter what they look like. It doesn't matter what the fuck they're doing. You go to the gym because you want to go. It's got nothing to do with whether you exercise or not. And it's this kind of breaking down that connection between hating yourself and exercising. It's still prevalent. It's still there. But I think, like you say, I don't really attract people, clients like that anymore who are looking to train in that way. And you're probably the same. You probably don't attract people like that as well.
Well, I mean, I think everybody gets what I call the moment. You know, that moment you look in the mirror and you go, oh shit, oh, that body fat wasn't there. And, oh, that, you know, the moment I need to change.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing to get. Having the moment that, like, I don't want it to get any worse than this is fine. It's how you react in that moment then. And like, basically the mindset you carry forward. Am I going to go ahead and change and understand? Yeah, I'm probably not where I want to be, but if I don't change a certain behavior and a certain specific set of patterns, I don't have a chance of becoming who I'd like to become and who I said I'd become.
Exactly. And it's that thing of, actually, it's very much like, very much founded in kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, in that of, like, for example, seeing yourself in the mirror, feeling shit about it, then what are you going to do? You're going to change it? You're going to go to the gym because you hate yourself? Or you're going to go to the gym because you want to feel good and love your body? It's in that behavior of deciding what to do that really is the catalyst for how you're going to feel at the gym and what results you are going to get. If you can make that thing of looking in the mirror, feeling kind of like okay about yourself, just kind of like diluting that feeling a bit and then going to do something that makes you feel a bit better, it just kind of sucks that hate for yourself out of it, which, I don't know, I'm not qualified in CBT or cognitive behavior therapy, but I think there is a lot to be said in that, in terms of why people train and why people make habits and create behaviors that are going to either make them better or, you know, make them hate themselves more, like you say.
And all the good advice in the world, all this mindset spiel and all this motivational malarkey, which I actually kind of hate, is nothing if it only takes an argument with your boss to set you off, or if you accept a comment from a friend, so quote unquote friend or work colleague or sister-in-law or brother-in-law, if you let somebody else's words affect you, or if you have a bad day at work and you stress eat and you can't pull yourself out of that moment and think, well, what will eating shit add to this moment? There's so many other variables that come into play. And again, this is way beyond my area of scope, because how do I tell somebody not to worry about what their brother-in-law thinks of them? Like, we've all had a backhanded comment. We've all had something scathing. We're all insecure about stuff. I'm sure all our insecurities get very much pointed out. And if you allow that to trigger you and resort back into the same repeat behaviors, I'm always encouraging people that I work with, that I'm friends with, certainly, I'm like, look, if a behavior triggered a certain response in you, how can you expect the other person to change if you're not willing to change your response? Like, you can't control what happens to you in life. You can only control how you react, which sounds nice and motivational, but, like, if you call me a fat guy now, if you called me a fat guy and I go behaving in a certain way, it's up to me to change my interpretation of the comment, how I feel about myself. It's not up to you. You can be as scathing or as venomous as you want. It doesn't matter that I think you shouldn't be like that. Why should you have the same respect for me that I expect if I don't give it to myself? But I mean, it's easy again for me to sit here and say that in a podcast. I'm sure there's years and years of reasoning and all that stuff behind it, and it's way out of my area of scope. I'll always try and talk to somebody pragmatically about it if they ask me, but I mean, I don't know how to fix that by any means.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not in our scope of practice, but sometimes we are dealing with the outcome of these behaviours. So we always refer on, but at the end of the day, it's better for us to understand where these things are coming from. And it's, as a coach, you need to understand these things in a way. It doesn't mean you should be, you know, giving someone therapy. That's not it at all. It's just you need to understand where these things are coming from so that you can help deal with why someone's missing their training sessions, deal with why someone is binge eating, for example, deal with why these things are happening in terms of them pushing themselves too much at the gym, so they're overtraining, you know?
Yeah, because I don't mind delving into this with clients, to be honest, which I'll tell you the truth. I don't mind personally delving into it. I only disclaimer it in public, but like, you don't know that somebody's just actually not one little piece of knowledge away from it. Like, you don't know that somebody's not correct. Like, if I know for sure, I know people that are still afraid of a slice or two of bread. So if they eat a slice of bread, that triggers the fuck it button mentality, as I call it.
Yeah.
And then they go and eat 10 tubs of ice cream because they had one slice of bread.
Mm-hmm.
And like, something like that, where I'm like, you know, what did the 10th tub of ice cream offer you that the first two didn't satisfy? And, you know, you may not change somebody's thinking by any means, but you might actually start to change people's thinking pragmatically. With, like, when's the last time you allowed yourself to enjoy a slice of bread without, you know, without eating 52 packets of shit? You know,
exactly.
Never. Like, why is that? Like, why is that? Oh, well, someone told me 12 years ago bread's bad. I'm like, and you never challenged that? Like,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of, it's in our duty as well. If someone's been told that carbs are bad and bread's bad, to say something that will kind of help people rationalize that and help people see that it's not, that that might not be the case. But I think people do look up to coaches a lot. So if they have had some advice in the past and maybe we hear it, it's important for us to dispute it and important for us to bring it up and obviously educate people a little bit more. And in doing
I think
so,
the best... Yeah. Oh, sorry, I thought you were finished. Apologies.
No, I am. You go.
I was just going to say, yeah, I completely agree about the education part. And I think one of the most empowering things that you can tell a client to do is never, ever listen to... Technically, this is an irony because what I'm about to say is a statement, but never listen to a statement made in absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
Everything will require context.
Yeah.
Like, if I said to you, and I say this to clients all the time, if I said to you, never eat ice cream, it's fattening, that is a false statement. That is a false statement. Ice cream is not fat. That's the equivalent of me saying, do not buy a sofa, it'll make you broke.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know? I don't know your financial situation. Now, if I said, based on the fact that your caloric intake is massive, if you have another highly caloric food like ice cream, you'll probably push yourself into more of a surplus, and the likelihood of fat gain based on your current lifestyle is higher.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably a little bit more true of a statement. The context, like if I said to you, you have no money left in the bank, do not go into overdraft by buying a sofa this week. Tidy up your spending habits, and then when you need furniture, purchase it accordingly. And all of a sudden, I find even something like that. If you're dealing with someone that is in a mind space to think a bit more pragmatically about food, and you hammer, and I mean hammer enough analogies and simple advice at them, I have found they'll come around to good ways of thinking. I like to believe, like, for example, I always use my two clients that are documenting their journey because they're walking proof. But I have one client who's down 160 pounds on Instagram and another who's down about 100. And both of them will tell you that I'm probably the first trainer or first thing to come along, and I've never, ever, ever, ever told either of them a food to eat or not to eat. Mm-hmm. I've told them to make their own decision and own it based on their lifestyle, their target, and a bit of cop on. And all of a sudden, I'm empowering, and same with any good trainer. They're empowering people to start thinking for themselves and making decisions not based out of fear or loathing, but based out of actual true empowerment. Like, yeah, it's probably better to be in an overall deficit for the week, but if you really do want to go on holiday, you know, what's one week in the year?
Mm-hmm.
But similarly, it's probably not a good idea to eat two tubs of ice cream during the football match because it's a massively caloric food. But the choice is yours. Do what the fuck you want.
Yeah, and that's why I'm quite a fan of flexible dieting, for example, and letting people make their own decisions with food choices. To an extent, obviously, if people need more rigidity, then obviously you need to kind of give them that. But actually, rarely do I need to say to someone, okay, stay away from this, don't eat this. It's actually never I say that. It allows people that flexibility to eat whatever they want to eat, to the point where, you know, we do rein people in, you know, give a bit of tough love when it's necessary. But with people to have that free roam, that free range with what they eat, it means that they can set their own boundaries and actually become empowered that they're not going to need us one day. We don't want people to need us forever as a coach. That's not our jobs. We're there to help them to make sure that they can learn the habits to get there so that they don't need us one day. But, you know, I think that the problem that I've seen, and I don't know if you've seen this with people that have come to you, there is the emphasis on the 12-week shreds, the 12-week until you go on holiday. And I think people will be booking their holidays now. And you're looking at, what, like 3 months until people go away? This is when people are going to be starting their 12-week shreds or whatever with a coach. Now, the problem with these shreds, you've seen it, I've seen it, is that afterwards there is no escape route. There's no plan afterwards. And actually in that, it creates that dependency on the coach that afterwards you're going to put the weight back on and you're going to have to go back to the coach again. It's a very different model from what me and you do in that we say, okay, yeah, sure, you've got a holiday in that time, but that shouldn't change anything with what you're doing right now. And this is the worrying thing that I see as a trend in the industry of creating that dependency on the coach. And I'm not bad mouthing anyone. That's not what I'm doing at all. I'm just saying it would be nice if things started to change a bit more away from that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I wholeheartedly agree, quite passionately, in fact. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I think the only thing you can do in that case is literally become the change you want to see. Mm-hmm. I do agree. I think these 6 to 8, 12 week shreds from someone who may not be thinking about the aftermath, from someone who's just looking for a qualified to offer the advice, I think are way more harmful than they are good. I know a lot of people that get more fucked psychologically and physiologically from these things than they'd like to admit. And the worst thing is, I can get past that part, except for the fact they think all the rebound weight gain is their fault and they're lacking discipline.
That's the bit that infuriates me. It makes me angry.
Yeah, same. I get it. But again, you know what? Similar to the way I had to learn the hard way years back, if you fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice, shame on me. I mean, I would have never done a diet like I did the first time, a second time, because it was so disheartening and to a degree soul-destroying and everything you can think of, that to think that I was put on a diet of under 50 grams of carbohydrates a day while training two or three times is not something I like to think back with fondness, especially now when I look at my current intake, which is 500-600 grams of carbohydrates some days. I metabolize carbohydrates so much more efficiently than I do fats, and that's something I had to learn the hard way. So that's great. That's a brilliant lesson that I know, and that's not made me go to the other extreme and think, well, I am a carb-adapted fat. Let's put everyone on a high-carb diet. Now the philosophies. I had to learn the hard way what worked for me. I'm going to need to find a system what works for this person. But if you're talking about a holiday, you're better off to give yourself ample time and a sustainable 8 out of 10 protocol. You really are. I mean, it's a very loose guideline, but if you go 10 out of 10 for half the year and then back to 0 out of 10, which is usually what happens with these things, you're averaging not even a 5 out of 10 for most of the year. And nobody wants to be a 5 out of 10. Mm-hmm. But if you just give yourself the permission to be an 8, 8.5 all the time, all the time, you're just in a much better place.
Do you think if someone had said to you when you were doing the ridiculous low carb, like taking the calories down, doing all of that stuff, someone said to you, Paul, you're going to regret this. You're doing the wrong diet plan. This is going to mess up your head and your relationship with food. Would you have stopped doing it?
No, I wouldn't have stopped doing it. No way.
And same with me. Same with me at the time. I wouldn't have done it.
I wouldn't have stopped doing it. Like, I mean, there's a lot of stupid things I did. Like if you came to me and said, don't take an 8-week course of injectable steroids, I wouldn't have listened. If you'd have said to me, don't do this crash diet, I wouldn't have listened. If you'd have told me, don't get wrapped up in how you look, I wouldn't have listened. It's the best thing I ever did. It's really freed me. I mean, I don't want to go onto this on a podcast, you're talking about clients, but it's really connected me to life. It's really connected me to the little bit of spirituality I have. It's made me a better boyfriend. It's made me a better partner. It's made me a better trainer. It's made me understand human emotion a bit better. It's made me go almost, not go the other way entirely, but I'm gone vegetarian on the basis that I appreciate life just that little bit more. And I think everybody should have a right to it. And I don't want to be a part. It's it's shaped a very different outlook on my part of this obsessive compulsive need we have, this weird perfectionism. It's you know that phrase, like, we use money we don't have to buy things we don't like to impress people we hate, or whatever the fuck it is. I'm not unconvinced that a lot of us train for a body for the same reason. Like, I want Kate to think I have nice abs. Fuck Kate. Like, I don't care what Kate thinks.
And same, you know, to you, Paul.
Yeah, and the way it should be. There should be no part of you that thinks if Paul or Kate is wrapped up in any way of how I look, beyond that of my own interpretation of myself, that I should give a shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think as well, like, you have to have gone to that point to see it from that perspective. And then, I don't know, maybe not. I mean, we share that experience in it, and so we share that belief with it, and that we just don't really care about that kind of thing as much anymore. To an extent, we do, in terms that we like to move well, we like to feel good, we like to feel healthy, we like to look all right. You know, everyone to an extent wants to look good. It's kind of wired into us as humans, you know, a little bit. However, we've gone to that point and come the other side of it. However, a lot of clients won't have got to that point, so they don't have that reference point to come back from and be like, oh well, you know,
you're so spot on. I couldn't agree more. Like, a lot of people won't have that reference point to go back and think, like, I'll never have the reference point of having $1 million company and thinking, oh well, $1 million didn't make me happy, therefore, etc. But I just, because of the physique thing, it's just a nice metaphor to know that once you meet your baseline level of needs, probably more is not the answer. But you're right, like, and my whole thing is, don't aim to look sexy as fuck. It's don't get attached. Don't get attached. If you get attachment, is the root of all disappointment. Attachment is the root of everything you don't want to feel.
Yeah, and it's a weird thing to think, like, this is a weird thought process for me, and it's actually massively empowered me. However, it might sound a little bit strange, but we're not going to look this way forever. We're going to be old one day. So, you know, you better work on other stuff. You better kind of, like, make yourself a better person. Open a few more doors for people. Smile a little bit more. What can you bring to the world other than the way you look? Because we're not going to be here one day. And that's a little bit philosophical for a fitness podcast, and I'm sorry. But I think it's actually quite related in terms of how much emphasis people place on how they look. And it's an empowering thing. It's not, oh shit, what's the point? It's, okay, well, cool. That's just a little bonus as to what I can bring to the world other than just abs, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. I often worry, and I'm always curious to know that, similar to what we talk about being attached to it, I'm always wondering, are overweight people often attached or stuck to the fact that they'll feel shit about themselves for life? It's a question I ask myself quite a bit.
That's a really interesting question. What, almost like because maybe they've grown up in that way, they're attached to almost feeling that way about themselves because it feels natural and it feels comfortable and that's normal.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. And that's one of these things that we kind of, like, obviously we stay in our scope of practice, but when we have a chat about things, this is genuinely what we talk about. And it's like, as a role of a coach, you are dealing with these things in terms of thinking, why is someone doing that?
I don't think it's outside of your scope of practice as they're challenging somebody on their core beliefs and their philosophical outlook. I think giving somebody advice to diseases like depression or whatever it is dangerous. I don't think challenging somebody's self-esteem is a bad thing.
Yeah. That's the thing. The more you learn about it, the more you kind of, like, realize what is in your scope of practice and what isn't. But I think backing away from the whole thing entirely, when you know that you could potentially help someone, is a little, you know, it's not what you do. Are you still going to start studying psychology? Is that still something that's on the cards for you?
Yes, but because I'm going to go, I really want to travel more. And because my beautiful better half has, as I've seen to you before we went on, that my beautiful better half has just recently gotten a job in Vietnam. She's probably going to kill me because I don't know if I'm telling people yet.
I'll release it at a later date when it's okay to not get you in trouble.
it's all good. I think she knows I'm a bit excited. Yeah, because of the travel plans. I don't know. I don't know. I'll definitely do it, but travel has my heart right now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you're at a point in your life where you can travel, you don't have any responsibilities, Paul, like, definitely do. Like, when I was working in London, I had a client who, one of my last sessions in London, they were like, you're young, go travel before you have kids and everything starts getting really stressful. And I was like, I'm going to take that advice and run with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I didn't do a J1 trip in college, and like, I don't want to look back at from 40 and think, Jesus, I should have done a travel at 29.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Got time to do it, and you know, you're working online, so we can do it, which is a huge, huge thing in our favour as well. So that's good. Yeah, I think we've pretty much covered everything we wanted to cover on our little catch-up. But yeah. If you've been listening, thank you very much for listening to mine and Paul's little chat about everything, really. If you found it helpful at all, make sure you do share and give it a rating. Thank you very much.